for our blind and print impaired listeners. Your North Carolina Reading Service brings you the Indie Week. Well, John Federson at the broadcast controls again in our refurbished North Carolina Reading Service dirigible high above Raleigh. I must say I personally love the new addition of our North Carolina Reading Service parachutes, bearing, of course, our distinctive logo. And speaking of love, our issue, dated February the 9th, 2022, features some love-related articles today, and we'll get to them amongst all our other stories from Indie Week. And Tomasi McDonald's opening column, History Repeating. Last month, the Durham City County Planning Department approved a site plan for a Triangle Developers proposal to build 379 single-family home and townhouse community that would cover nearly 60 acres of land near West Point on the Eno Park and the Eno River. There is an emerging groundswell of support for the project, notably among a 300-member, predominantly black church congregation, whose sanctuary is about a 6-minute walk from the proposed project site. Groundbreaking, however, remains far from a shoe-in for the proposed development on an area known as Black Meadow Ridge, which sits along the southern boundary of West Point on the Eno, the city's flagship park. North Durham opponents of the development, most notably the nearly 60-year-old Eno River Association, are awaiting the outcome of a Board of Adjustment, BOA, public hearing on February 25th. That's when the BOA will consider an appeal that seeks to reverse a 2016 Planning Department decision that has allowed the project to proceed without input from the City Council or the public. The appeal was filed on behalf of the project's opponents in March 2020 by Chapel Hill attorney T.C. Morphis, Jr. Morphis states in the appeal that a proposed 1972 housing development known as Foxmoor was contingent upon the existence of Eno Drive. Foxmoor, which called at the time for 412 units, and the construction of Eno Drive was, quote, ultimately scrapped, owing to its likely devastating impact on this most environmentally sensitive area of Durham. Meanwhile, Durham attorneys William Bryan and Jeffrey Rother with the Morningstar Law Group on behalf of the developer last year countered the homeowner's appeal by filing a motion with the BOA to, quote, exclude the appeal narrative that focused on the development's environmental impact. The Durham attorneys did not respond last week to an email or phone call from Indy. As previously reported, Christy Benson, an Elon law professor, says the fight to save the Eno from overdevelopment dates back to the early 1970s with a proposal to construct Eno Drive. Benson says the project never gained traction, thanks in large part to Margaret Nygaard, the legendary activist who is known as the, quote, mother of the Eno. Benson says she came out fighting mad and slowly beat back the proposed Eno Drive. There was a massive public outcry. Benson says the developers of the new proposed community are riding the coattails of the obsolete Foxmoor development. Opponents of the project in recent months have garnered the support from the children of Holger and Margaret Nygaard. Holger Nygaard was a distinguished Duke University professor of medieval literature, ballads, and folklore. The couple's life-defining work in the Bull City was spearheading a movement more than 50 years ago to save the Eno River from becoming a city reservoir. They and others in 1965 formed the Eno Historical Society, which was later renamed and now called the Eno River Association, according to the UNC Chapel Hill Southern Historical Collection. Kirsten Nygaard, one of the couple's daughters, told Indy, "We're never distanced from the Eno River Association. It's in our blood with what's going on with the Eno." Kirsten Nygaard, a retired physician's assistant who lives in Orange County, called the proposed development a tragedy for residents in the surrounding communities, for the city of Durham, for West Point on the Eno, and for the city's water supply. Her sister, Jennifer Nygaard, says she became involved in the fight to save Black Meadow Ridge after reading the Indy's September story about the issue. And she stated in an email, "I have felt galvanized to do something to try to protect the Eno at West Point, as I regard it to be the worst problem for the Eno that has happened since my mother's death." Jennifer Nygaard is a visual artist whose work with the Eno River Association dates back to her early teens. Her art on the covers of the association's brochures, calendars, and newsletters feature aquatic species that are unique to the Eno, including the Neuse River water dog, the extremely rare Virginia pebble snail, the redback salamander, the yellow lamp mussel, and the Roanoke bass, a game fish that's described as the world's rarest. Jennifer Nygaard told Indy, "These creatures are important bioindicators of the water quality." Her concerns were amplified more than three decades ago with an inventory of Durham County's natural areas, plants, and wildlife prepared by the NC Natural Heritage Program. The editors, Elizabeth Pullman and Alice Watson, stated, quote, "Water quality within the Eno is particularly threatened by the proliferation of impervious surfaces, lawns, and other non-point surfaces of pollution. The eroding effects of stormwater runoff also threaten natural communities, particularly where tributary ravines cross through the park's boundaries in areas where development approaches the edge of the steep bluffs above the Eno." Opponents of the development say they're fighting to block what they envision as tightly packed houses, replacing a 10-minute walk through the woods and a tree-lined walking trail to the city park and Eno River, but not before enduring Black Meadow Ridge's hardwood trees being clear-cut and the sloping land's granite foundations blasted away, then graded smooth. More pointedly, they say the community is on the cusp of an environmental nightmare, and noted that a December 2018 city report titled Eno River Watershed Implement Plan states, "The top threat to the river water quality and watershed health is stormwater runoff from impervious surfaces." While awaiting the February hearing with the BOA, the opponents are fighting approval for the development's water quality permit from the NC Division of Water Resources, which has regulatory oversight of the city's water supply. In a letter to state water quality officials, members of Save Black Meadow Ridge Group argued the development will harm the city's long-term water supply plans, which include a new water intake at Nello Tier Quarry to provide drinking water to city residents. The tier quality, less than a mile from the proposed development, has already been used since 2007 as an emergency water supply for Durham and Orange counties, and now, with plans for use as a long-term solution, the development's opponents told state officials the proposed high-density housing, quote, "will generate significant amounts of runoff and cause downstream water pollution." The current plan is for the Tier Quarry intake to fill only during times of high base flow from the Eno River and Lake Mishi, which corresponds to the times of the high runoff, the group members state in the letter. Quote, "This would mean higher levels of pollution entering the intake from the development, in particular from the Black Meadow Creek tributary within 1 mile of that intake." The activist letter to state water quality officials also pointed to public safety issues with stormwater runoff contamination into Warren and Black Meadow Creeks, particularly in the mouths of the two tributaries that are, quote, "at some of the highest used places on the West Point and the Eno City Park for swimming, fishing, and recreation. In particular, the pools at the end of Black Meadow are used for fishing and playing in, especially by younger children with their families," the group stated. Warren Creek, on the other hand, flows near Sennett's Hole, which is used by hundreds of people every summer weekend for swimming, fishing, and recreation. The parcel of land is targeted for development by Chapel Hill developer Keith T. Brown, who has a reputation for building opulent, modernist homes. But last week, Timothy Hill, a coffee importer who lives in the Argonne Hills subdivision, told Indy that Brown has outsourced the project to D.R. Horton, formerly Terramore Homes, a national company that refers to itself as America's Builder. In September, officials with Terramore offices in North Raleigh applied for a permit from the NC Division of Water Resources to, quote, permanently impact more than 4,000 square feet of wetlands and 149 square feet of streams to construct the residential development. In an email to the Indy, Ben Lennon, president of D.R. Horton's Central Carolina Division, said the company is currently under contract to purchase the project from a local developer. However, quote, we do not yet own the reference property. We are extremely excited about the opportunity to provide much-needed housing at affordable price points in this area of Durham. Our proposed project will allow residents to live closely to and enjoy the West Point on the Eno River. Lennon said D.R. Horton's plans include, quote, a greenway connection through the property, which would not only allow future residents to have walking access to the park, but would also allow neighboring communities to access it as a public greenway trail. We are hopeful that this project may serve as a catalyst of development in the area, something that many of the neighbors of the project have expressed interest in. Timothy Hill and Jennifer Nygaard both say that about 1,200 people submitted letters expressing their disapproval of the development to state water quality officials prior to a January 20 public hearing. But there is support for the project among residents who point to an acute affordable housing crisis exacerbated by a limited housing inventory. Robert Northam Jr. is the pastor of the Faith Community Church, an 8,000-square-foot structure that sits on just over 10 acres of land, a stone's throw away from the proposed project. He says, we're the gateway to the Eno. Northam says the nearly 24-year-old church has been in its current location since 2008. Although the majority of its members are African-American, the church members include Hispanic and white worshipers. The majority of the church members live in North Durham. The average age is 38, and about 60% own their homes. Northam told Indy this week that he, along with the overwhelming majority of the church members, support the project. Quote, I've talked with our members individually and collectively. The church is excited to support the project. I am in the people's business. I believe having 300-plus homes near the church gives us the opportunity to help people. The church's stance on the proposed development, the pastor added, is about, quote, seeing North Durham progress and move forward. Northam says the church has a team that has researched proposed developments in the area, and he's confident that city leaders will hold the developers accountable to protect the Eno's legacy, which includes providing the region with safe drinking water. He also notes that he has seen a diminished interest in the park over the past 20 years, and that future homeowners near West Point on the Eno will use the area for walking, running, jogging, and walking their dogs, saying, it's literally going to bring opportunities to what the development opponents are fighting against. I believe it's going to resurrect interest. Scott Carpenter, a lifelong Durham resident who supports the project, thinks opposition to the development smacks of elitism. Quote, the problem of NIMBYism is what's at issue here, says Carpenter, who has purchased two homes in North Durham since 1992, wrote in his letter of support, quote, there are too many transplants that buy their slice of the residential pie and then decide no one else should get access to their area of the environment. Where do they think the next generation of adults is supposed to live? Where do they think the next group of future Durham residents are supposed to go? They focus purely on the future increase in their own property values while piously claiming they want to protect the environment over and over again. Funny. I never hear these environment-protecting naysayers volunteer to tear down their own homes and replace them with reforestation projects. It's always, no, don't build anything new now that I've gotten my piece of the pie. The cost and availability of housing, Carpenter says, is becoming a major problem in the area. This new home-building project is needed in North Durham. The Nygaard siblings disagree. Kirsten says, sure, there's a need for good, affordable housing, but this is not the spot. This is a natural environment that should not be disturbed by bulldozers. It's not just my parents' legacy. It's the legacy of thousands of people in the community. It's part of what makes Durham so special. Her sister Jennifer Nygaard says, green spaces and affordable housing are not mutually exclusive of each other. My mother predicted that we would have to defend what we had saved, and she saw this as never-ending. Next to Jeremy Borden from the Indie Week from Chapel Hill. Raw deal. 2 years ago, UNC Chapel Hill was embroiled in tumult over its controversial decision to hand over funds, along with its Silent Sam statue, to a neo-Confederate group. Now, new documents obtained under a public records request to the state attorney general show that the offices of North Carolina Governor Cooper and Attorney General Josh Sines signed off on a major increase in the amount an outside lawyer was allowed to bill on the issue, to the tune of $250,000. The state's top two Democrats authorized that payday in January of 2020 to the outside law firm of Womble Bond Dickinson and Attorney Ripley Rand. The move raises more questions around state leaders' conduct that nearly paved the way for $2.5 million and the infamous metal statue to be given to the Sons of Confederate Veterans, SCV. In February 20th, following weeks of protest and scrutiny from civil rights groups and attorneys, Judge Alan Badur, the same judge who had originally approved the deal between UNC and SCV, ultimately threw out the legal settlement. The future of Silent Sam had vexed campus and state leaders since protesters toppled it from its perch in 2018, but the original settlement between SCV and the university that details would later reveal had all the markings of a sordid backroom deal was enough money to legitimize and permanently endow an organization avowed to spreading and celebrating the white supremacist mythology of the lost cause. The managing attorney for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, Elizabeth Haddix, which was part of the successful push to have that deal scrapped, says the money the state authorized to spend raises questions, asking, these are public dollars going to pay a private firm for legal expenses. What did Mr. Rand spend his time on? What did he bill for? Rand has not responded to emailed questions posed about his firm's work. Stein's office also could have gotten directly involved in the case if it had chosen to do so, including while attorneys sought to unwind the settlement, says Haddix. She says her organization tried to engage Stein at several points in seeking to get the settlement overturned as they formally filed court motions to intervene in the case. Quote, we were extremely disappointed about how Attorney General Stein responded to this. Given that the public money issue had already been a major issue in the case, the lack of transparency, the obvious collaboration between the Board of Governors and the SCV, Ripley Rand's personal relationship with Judge Badur, and the improper back-channel communications that happened all around the case and before the consent order was entered was a real concern. After the university approved that SCV deal the day before Thanksgiving in 2019, an uproar quickly ensued and spiraled. A major donor pulled funding from the university. The student university newspaper, the Daily Tar Heel, sued the Board of Governors for an alleged violation of the state's open meetings law. A national civil rights group pushed to overturn the entire agreement amid protests on campus decrying Silent Sam. The new documents, released more than 2 years after a December 2019 request and reported first last week by WBTV, show those offices, at least officially, didn't give the issue much thought. So Chief Deputy Attorney General Alexander Peters wrote to Cooper's General Counsel, William McKinney, who signed off on the new $250,000 cap, quote, "Due to the timing of the matter, the availability of our attorneys, and Mr. Rand's familiarity with the issues involved, it would be impracticable for this office to provide the required services." Greg Doucette, a Durham attorney who first blew the whistle on the irregular settlement between SCV and the Board of Governors by pointing out the lawsuit was filed and settled within minutes, says Stein in particular had a duty to step in, saying, "I think it was malpractice by the Attorney General's office. The whole thing was corrupt as blank." Doucette says a criminal investigation is warranted. He believes Rand's statement in court and by university in legal filings constitute a sham legal proceeding. The so-called settlement, he says, was a way for the university to make a deal without the required transparency for the allocation of university funds. Cooper's press secretary, Jordan Monahan, wrote in an emailed response to a series of questions that the governor's office, quote, "routinely signs off on requests for outside counsel when recommended by the North Carolina Department of Justice." And Stein's spokesperson, Nazneen Ahmed, wrote in an email that the attorney general's role was limited to assessing only if UNC and the BOG were legally allowed to enter the agreement. Quote, "We learned about the agreement the University and Board of Governors negotiated in this matter only after it occurred." As to whether Stein should have intervened more forcefully given his professed interest in civil rights issues and why the office deemed the agreement legal, Ahmed said, quote, "Without authorization from UNC, we're not allowed to discuss privileged matters relating to this, including any attorney-client communications or legal conclusions of lawyers in our office." He wrote, "Stein's office cannot open a criminal investigation into the case because the AG's office represents state agencies and universities as clients. Any criminal investigation would fall to local district attorneys." Doucette says prosecutors in Orange and Wake counties would have jurisdiction, but he's not aware of any ongoing investigation. UNC and the Board of Governors will get even less oversight and scrutiny in the future when it comes to legal work. A provision quietly tucked into a coronavirus relief bill signed by Governor Cooper says that UNC's Board of Governors, quote, "may authorize the expenditure of funds to hire private counsel to represent the board, university, and any constituent institution." Monahan, Cooper's spokesperson, wrote, "Legislators, without input or request from our office, included language in pandemic relief legislation allowing the UNC system to hire outside counsel without seeking that approval in the future." Stein's spokesperson said their office was also not involved in changing the university system's legal oversight process. Likely, most of the legal work had been completed by the time officials in the governor's and attorney general's offices approved both the initial cap of $125,000 and the increase to $250,000, says Hugh Stevens, the attorney who represented the Daily Tar Heel in its lawsuit alleging a violation of the State Open Meetings Act, saying, "I think the way it's supposed to work is that no lawyer should be hired or do 1 minute's billable work without first having their employment being signed off on by the Attorney General or Governor." One of the primary legal issues at hand was whether the SCV ever had a claim to silence Sam in the first place. The university was likely well aware of the issue, as it first gave $74,999, $1 short of a requirement that would have triggered a review by the Attorney General, to the SCV in a separate transaction. The university has admitted that a portion of those funds were spent to buy rights to the statue from the United Daughters of the Confederacy. A university historian later clarified that the SCV had no legal rights to silence Sam, and thus a court could not award the group the property as part of any legal settlement. Even this SCV's leader was stunned at the turn of events, writing in a letter to its membership leaked to Doucette and later made public, quote, "What we have accomplished is something that I never dreamed we would accomplish in 1,000 years, and all at the expense of the university itself." Stephen's view is more charitable than Doucette's, as he says that decisions judged in hindsight are often cast in a harsh light when it comes to how the university and state leaders dealt with Silent Sam. Stephen said, quote, "It's easy to look back and see where things should have been done differently. Someone should have been a lot more diligent with research into whether SCV could legally retain title. I don't have any problem with the fact that the system hired Womble to handle this matter. Ripley's a good lawyer, his colleagues are good lawyers, and they have a well-developed reputation. The only reason I think it's an issue at all is that it's a lot of money, and it turned out to be for nothing." Alan Badur, the Superior Court judge who originally agreed to the settlement and who, WBTV reports, was meeting and texting with those involved before the settlement was filed, eventually threw out the deal, and the bulk of the money was never allocated after weeks of protest. Badur didn't respond to several questions, but did say in an email that he has, quote, "previously released all public records I have regarding the case." Badur is running for re-election this year and is unopposed thus far. Both the Badur and Rand families are considered royalty in North Carolina legal circles and know each other well, says Doucette. In the end, Haddix says outside of her official role in the case, she reacts to events as a North Carolina attorney, saying, "The fact is there are procedural rules in court, professional ethical obligation that members of the court and judges have to comply with. Based on the evidence that I saw, all of those rules were thwarted, in this case by a number of different individuals who were never held accountable." Doucette, a criminal defense attorney, says the case is another example of America's two-tiered justice system. Quote, "I hate to say this, but I think that's politics. You have people getting away with stuff that for any normal person would put you in jail for 20 years. Civil rights lawyers, including a group known as the Black Pioneers, ultimately intervened to save the university from itself. The lawyers' committee asked on behalf of its clients, led by student Devian Drew, that the $2.5 million go toward campus diversity efforts, though some had already been spent in legal fees. There's no indication that university leaders are looking at reallocating those funds. North Carolina's top two Democrats are hardly the biggest villains in the Silent Sam episode. The parties to the deal were Rand and University Attorney Tom Shanahan, SCV Lawyer Boyd Sturgis, and UNC Chapel Hill Vice Chancellor for Public Affairs Clayton Summers, reported the Daily Tar Heel. Board of Governors Chairman Randy Ramsey defended the deal in its aftermath. There may have been other players involved that have not been revealed, but in the end, attorneys argue state leaders with oversight responsibilities should have intervened. Haddix saying, "There should have been a lot more transparency, and there should have been a lot more questions asked by those public officials." Next column from Brian Rosenzweig, A Central Location. It's about recycling in Orange County. During his more than 30 years working with Orange County's Solid Waste Department, Blair Pollack was instrumental in expanding recycling programs and access across the county. Now, he's not thrilled that one of Chapel Hill's longest-standing recycling sites is set to close this spring. Pollack, who retired last year, was a UNC Chapel Hill graduate student when the town of Chapel Hill hired him in 1987 to initiate public recycling programs across the town and eventually the county. In the 1990s, Pollack helped establish an unstaffed drop-off recycling center at University Place, that 1970s-era shopping center just off Franklin Street, which in the following years would become a major part of Orange County's recycling system. With the central location by the mall and Harris Teeter, the site not only became a popular drop-off location, but was critical to local recycling and disposal efforts. Pollock recalls hosting regular motor oil and mixed paper drives at the University Place site in the 1990s, saying, "We would have these quarterly drives and hundreds of people would show up." Suffice it to say, there's a long-standing relationship between the community and the mall. Much has changed about Chapel Hill and Orange County's recycling program in the past 3 decades. With Pollock's help, publicly funded curbside recycling was established throughout most of the county. But Pollock says the University Place site is still vital, providing a convenient space for residents to drop off large recyclables, alongside easy access to the mall's various businesses. Now, less than a year after his retirement, it's set to be removed. In early January, the Florida-based development group RAM Realty Advisors provided notice of termination to Orange County. By January 31, the notice said all recycling containers at University Place would need to be removed. Based on approved redevelopment plans, the move was likely to make room for more parking spaces to accommodate new storefronts. On January 27th, just days before the scheduled removal, Orange County announced it had made an agreement with RAM Realty Advisors to extend the planned removal of the drop-off recycling center until May 31, a 4-month extension. A county statement read, "The property management group has agreed to extend the availability of the site so as to allow the solid waste department extra time to attempt to find another location for a replacement drop-off site." But Pollock hopes there's still time to save the University Place location. He asks, "It's in the interest of all members of the community to keep the site open, so why is the current owner so hot to get rid of it?" Other community members share Pollock's concern. Carrboro Town Council member Randy Haven O'Donnell says that for many years the University Place site has been a critical part of Orange County's recycling ecosystem. Haven O'Donnell says she worries that if the University Place site is removed, even 4 months from now, it could disrupt people's recycling habits, saying, "Recycling depends on two things. It depends on convenience and creating habits. And if you don't make it convenient, you won't create a habit. So when you pull out a convenient site that people have gotten accustomed to, what happens?" Samantha Corte, a Carrboro resident, says she often uses the drop-off center for larger materials like boxes that she doesn't want to pile up till the next collection date. Corte says she appreciates the convenience of the University Place site, especially for its proximity to Harris Teeter, saying, "I use it when I have cardboard boxes piling up, which is somewhat frequently, and I want to combine it with a trip to the grocery store. If I don't have other recyclables, I don't need to go to Eubanks." Aside from the University Place location, Orange County maintains 2 other full-service waste recycling centers, including that location on Eubanks Road in Chapel Hill and Walnut Grove Church Road in Hillsboro. The government has 3 additional unstaffed satellite sites for nearby neighborhoods in rural Chapel Hill, Mebane, and Eflin. But with its central urban location, the University Place location is especially convenient for Chapel Hill and Carrboro residents. Haven O'Donnell says that beyond risking breaking recycling habits by requiring people to drive further distances, the change could also increase gas emissions, essentially nullifying the environmental impacts of recycling, saying, "It's zero sum almost, in addition to the perception of whether or not it's convenient." So far, no formal plans have been announced for a replacement site. Robert Williams, director of the Orange County Solid Waste Department, said in an email that the county is continuing to search for locations for a new site. Williams didn't say whether any specific locations, like Central Chapel Hill, would be a prime consideration for the site, writing, "I think the location will be at a site that is open and has room for the public and Orange County crews to safely access." Haven O'Donnell stresses that decisions like this have serious implications for the ability of residents to practice good recycling habits and can have negative impacts for the environment. She points to the closure of the Carborough Plaza recycling site in 2017 to demonstrate the adverse impacts a closure or relocation can have. According to Chapel Borough, nearly 500 tons of recyclable materials were collected from the Carborough site over the course of a year. Since its closure, no new location has been established. And she says, convenience and habit is what makes the difference in community, climate action, and inaction. We can't talk about climate action without realizing these things are the underpinnings that make the change. And Pollux says he feels that even if a replacement site is built, it's still harmful to the community to remove a well-established local resource like the University Plate site. Quote, from my perspective, it's a valuable community asset. Can't something be done to hold on to it? Now, this column is an interview by Lee Taus with Cody Kinsley, who's head of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, the state's largest public agency. This is a Q&A. The Qs are started. Non-elected leaders rarely get on the public's radar, but your predecessor, Mandy Cohen, became a household name during the pandemic. How do you plan to fill these shoes, and what will your priorities be? And Mr. Kinsley answers, right now, our team is focused on responding to the pandemic. DHHS is all going to continue to do what it has always done, which is fight for the overall health and wellness of North Carolina. As we continue to try to get this pandemic to a more endemic stage, we're able to return to a sense of normalcy and have the best resources and science to drive that process. I'm focused on the overall health and wellness of the state and looking at key priorities that I've been pushing for my 4 years here, while also responding to the pandemic. They're centered on three things: behavioral health and resiliency. Second, health of children and families, or child and family well-being. And third, looking at building a strong and inclusive workforce. Child and family well-being, is that the adverse childhood experience approach? Answer, we have had a generation of children impacted by this pandemic, so it's absolutely about adverse childhood experiences, considering that collective trauma is one of those. But it's also about responding to that, building out school interventions, partnering with individuals to help provide kids with the tools they need to respond, and teachers and other staff in schools the resources they need to recognize mental health concerns. It's also about the foundational things that we know drive health: food security, food access. I'm proud that we are one of 8 states providing pandemic EBT cards. We have to continue to build on our SNAP and WIC programs. We have to continue to provide resources that are the building blocks of health for kids and healthy families. Then, also investing in early ed, providing teachers and early educators in the child care workforce with tools to respond to and address trauma, and, frankly, support them in having access to a living wage. We know that workforce is so critical for the lifelong health and wellness for our children. Looking at pandemic numbers, the Omicron surge seems to be trending downward. What do you make of the latest metrics? I'm hopeful, because we're starting to see the rapid decrease in cases we have seen in other places, other countries, and jurisdictions. Omicron ramped up very quickly. It was 4 to 6 times as contagious as Alpha, but we are seeing that fall off nearly as quick. We had a 35% decrease per population case rate this last week compared to the week prior, so I think we have peaked, and we are now on the downfall. It's also hopeful to see some early decrease in hospitalizations. That's good for our healthcare workforce, which has been at the forefront of this from the beginning and really stretched. There will always be variants. There is another potential variant on the horizon, and we're doing just as we did with this one: learn what to expect, follow the science, understand if it's going to be more transmissible, whether its severity profile is going to be more or less. This is a lot to learn with the BA2 variant. and we're watching it closely. We're going to, again, make sure we're fighting for North Carolina to have all the available resources necessary to help our response, and I'll do my job to make sure we are communicating with North Carolinians to know what to expect, and we can manage through this together. A few weeks ago, when Omicron was about to hit, people in the science community were talking about how the strain might possibly burn so quickly through communities that it might hasten the pandemic's end. What's your take on this? Is it the end in sight? The end is in sight for COVID as much as the end is in sight for the flu. This is a respiratory illness that we're going to have to live with for some time. The good news with the flu is that we all get our annual flu vaccine. In long-term care and certain healthcare settings, there are extra precautions to protect individuals that are most vulnerable, those who are older and more susceptible. But for the most part, we're able to go about our lives. We have vaccines, therapeutics, and effective testing. What the finish line looks with COVID-19 is getting closer, and that's really good. There are lots of questions about whether the Omicron variant provides significant protection against potential other variants. We should not discount the curveball that this virus can continue to throw at us, but the best news is that the vaccines that were formulated based on the initial variants continue to hold up, especially with the booster, incredibly well against Omicron, as it has with all the other variants. While the Omicron variant may have gotten a significant number of people with active infection some amount of immunity, we know the immunity you get from an active infection is significantly variable and less reliable than the vaccine. And that's why we continue to message the importance of the vaccine. Next hard-hitting question. Rams or Bengals? Answer. I watch figure skating. The last sporting event I went to was the World Figure Skating Championship in Greensboro. No, wait, it was the National. My partner would correct me on that. He would be so sad if I got that wrong. It was the National Figure Skating Championship. Are you talking about golf? I don't know which sporting event you're talking about, but I'll Google it later, and I will learn. Those are the two teams going to the Super Bowl. Answer. I'll encourage people to gather safely. That's really good. It's great for people to be with people, take care of themselves, maybe test before they go. Taylor Knopf now pens The Art of Healing for Iggy Koski. Music has been the one constant in his life, he says, the therapeutic value of music was very obvious to me at a very young age. At 7 years old, he fell in love with the guitar when he first heard Eric Clapton playing on the car radio. After that, Koski's father found the young boy strumming tennis rackets and broomsticks. He bought Koski his first guitar. The now 32-year-old Raleigh-based musician says, I love recording music. I use it as a process to psychoanalyze what's going on with myself because, subconsciously, lyrics will come up to the surface. I don't know what I'm saying, but they tell me what's going on with me. The song tells me how I'm feeling. Koski has always leaned into music as a way to help him understand and cope with his life's trauma. As a child, he witnessed the death of both parents in a murder-suicide. He moved in with a legal guardian, his older half-sister, whose husband was a guitar teacher, saying, he saw I had an interest in art and music, and he provided me with everything I needed to express myself. The man became like a father to him. He essentially gave me the keys to myself, which is the most freeing thing an adult can do for a teenager who has experienced horrors in life. Koski later lost another sister to suicide and his brother to a drug overdose. He says he self-medicated with drugs and alcohol and was later diagnosed with bipolar disorder. He went on to survive more trauma, including his own suicide attempts, homelessness, and a near-fatal drug overdose that landed him in the emergency room at age 30. there, he decided to make a change. From the hospital, Koski asked to go to Healing Transitions, a residential addiction recovery program in Raleigh. He's been in recovery for 2.5 years and released an album last year. People have long used creative expression to process life experiences, behaviors, and emotions. Some, like Koski, are drawn to art naturally. Others have discovered its healing power through therapy. Anna Salander, a licensed clinical therapist and art therapist based in Durham, has this to say. Art making is inherently therapeutic. It creates a space for people to have the benefits of just processing the meaning and content of whatever comes up in their artwork. It's using art in order to better express yourself or discover certain patterns that you're engaging in. Salander has led art therapy sessions for patients in every kind of setting, from hospital inpatient units to intensive outpatient programs to private therapy, both in person and virtually. She's worked with a lot of patients going through life transitions or dealing with medical diagnoses such as cancer, or who are struggling with addiction issues. She's also counseled caregivers of people with long-term physical or mental illness. She says she starts by establishing treatment goals and incorporates traditional mental health therapy techniques such as talk-based cognitive behavioral therapy. For some patients who have never worked with art, it can seem intimidating. Salander said she will start them with something like a collage, which is less threatening. And she says, the art kind of guides the work and makes my job a lot easier because a lot of stuff ends up coming up as people are expressing themselves creatively, and oftentimes they feel more safe doing it through art making than verbally. At the start of the pandemic, Salander thought leading virtual art therapy sessions would be really difficult, but she said it's been amazing and led to innovative forms of art. One client took a work email about pandemic-related changes and used it to create blackout poetry using Microsoft Paint to select words to express herself while covering the rest. Another client created an interactive video game in which he tackled his mental health struggles. He shared it with friends and family, and it opened the door for others to share about their mental health. She said, people got really inspired through the virtual component, which I hadn't anticipated and honestly didn't have a lot of experience in, so it ended up being really cool. Salander said she's also watched patients soothe themselves through art during moments of anxiety. Quote, maybe they're having physical symptoms like sweaty palms or racing heart when they're talking or working through some of this stuff. And in that moment, I'm helping them use their art materials often as a grounding experience. What are you smelling? What are you feeling and touching with your hands? Whether it's oil pastels or chalk or watching watercolors drip down the page. So it's both used as a kind of outlet and a grounding exercise. When Charlotte-based artist Melissa Fish stopped drinking alcohol, she said she would get thirsty around happy hour each day. Someone in her recovery group suggested she try baking to distract from her cravings, so she did. And it worked. She baked cookies and decorated them in royal icing designs. Fish, 45, had always been interested in art. In college, she started as an art major but quickly changed to something else. Feelings of doubt crept in, and she thought she wasn't good enough to be an artist. Fish got caught up in the college party scene, and her alcohol addiction snuck up on her. For the following decade, she stopped creating art altogether and kept drinking. By the time Fish was in baking cookies in recovery, she met artist Wendy White, who is now the director of development at Healing Transitions in Raleigh. White also leads art therapy groups for program participants and encourages people to embrace colors, textures, shapes, and movements rather than striving to make their art look like a certain picture in their head. Fish said, White saw her beautiful baked goods and fanned the creative embers in her. The two artists also bonded over their journeys of recovery from addiction and similar feelings of self-doubt as artists. White said of their conversations, Just by sharing that I had never felt comfortable calling myself an artist, and now I was saying, No, I am an artist. I am creative. I am worthy of this expression. Painting and creating other forms of art allows Fish to practice what mental health professionals would call mindfulness. When Fish is creating, she's not thinking about the past or planning out the week or worrying about the future, saying, I'm literally where my feet are, where the art is. My brain is there. My body is there. And you just kind of get in the zone, and it's like being in a meditative state. I feel like that at any time that I'm creating art. In October, White hosted Healing Transition's first art event called Art of Recovery, where Fish displayed her work publicly for the first time. And Kosky also performed his music live at that event. As for him, he's found playing music with others to be therapeutic, too. At Healing Transition, he was allowed to bring his guitar and amp to the campus, and he jammed with others in the program. Playing music while sober was new for him, and at first Kosky was concerned that he wouldn't be as tapped into the music, he said, alluding to the romanticized idea some artists have about drugs and creativity. However, he discovered that writing, playing, and recording music while sober gave him clarity and insight into himself. He said, Being sober and doing it kind of clears the fog off the mirror. You can actually see yourself for what you really are and see all your blemishes, and those can be beautiful as well. You don't have to hide behind them by getting high or using alcohol or whatever. In recovery, Kosky said he has been able to purchase all the music equipment he previously sold off to buy heroin. He now has a modest recording studio in his room in a sober living house, including synthesizer, drum machine, software, bass, guitars, and microphones. He has everything he needs to make a record, but Kosky said he's learned he doesn't have to play all the instruments by himself. He can invite others in. And he says, Something I've learned through the process of getting into recovery is asking for help. Recovery promotes community. You're around like-minded people that know what it's like to carry your pain. He's taught guitar lessons to others in recovery and played in groups together. Now, Kosky says he's looking for more ways to help people experience the healing power of art and music. Now, folks, I've reached the cover story featuring love about relationships and in the Indie Week. And as I look through it, it's mostly about vibrators, sexual aids, and different forms of physical expression of love and attitudes. And because there's no time to read it all, I only have 4 minutes left, I'm going to bypass that. But if you went to indieweek.com, you can read that two-page article, which is titled Signs of the Sexy Times. But I'll go to reading what I can of a book titled Foreverland, the author, a Durham-based Heather Heverleski. She explores the, quote, divine tedium of holy matrimony. And I'll read just as much as I can, which is now 3 minutes worth. She's the author of the popular advice column Ask Polly, which has, since she began writing it in 2012, taken the genre to new heights with sprawling existential answers that are, in turn, nourishing, tender, brutally honest, and laced with profanity. As Polly Havrilesky encourages readers to embrace life's messiness and be honest about the limits of perfectionism. She doesn't, however, ever ask them to take up less space. She was long based in Los Angeles and moved to Durham, where she grew up. "This is where she's zooming with me now," writes Sarah Edwards, having adjusted her camera settings to satisfaction, and just begun interviews for her new book, Foreverland, on the divine tedium of marriage. The book, a reflection on her marriage, came out this week. "Even though I visited a lot, I forgot about bugs," Havrilesky says of her move back to the South. "I forgot about weeds. But I knew that I would enjoy being around smart, interesting people in an extremely community-oriented, creative place." She grew up in Durham with her father, a professor of economics at Duke, where she later studied. Then she moved to California. I'm cutting through this article as it's written initially for time. Also along the way came marriage to Bill, whom you will come to feel quite close to in Foreverland, and children, and the family moved to Durham last year. "I've been surprised at how little I found myself haunted by having grown up here," she says. "All the things I was worried be hard about this move have turned out easy. Being around my family is amazing. There's something about being in the same town with your family where you just understand each other better. Foreverland is in part about family and understanding each other, but it's also very much about the flaws and warts of marriage. That's the divine tedium part, the phlegmy partner and suburban tag-teaming at Little League games, the marital doubt and self-doubt. I knew I wanted to talk about the sorts of delights and perils of commitment and boredom and repetitiveness, but also the inherent gifts of companionship," said Havrilesky, who has been married 15 years. "As I got deeper into the book, I was confronted more and more with the arbitrary, strange, moralistic aspects of tying yourself to someone for the rest of your life." Well, my altimeter in our blimp shows that, indeed, my employers have decided to reel in the old gas bag for this issue of the Indie Week. This is a podcast, and after our initial airing, it's available in our vast library of programs for you to listen to again and again and again. But for now, the ncreadingservice.org, John Feddersen says to all of you, Happy Valentine's Day, and so long for now.